Welcome to the Talking City podcast, coming to you from the Manchester Evening News. My name's Joe Bray, joined by Simon Bajkowski. We're talking Real Madrid, a little bit of Luton, but I think it'll be mostly that big Real Madrid game at the Bernabeu. And there for us, Simon, in Madrid. I mean, firstly, it was good watching from home, but that must have been some atmosphere in the Bernabeu.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. Real Madrid versus City last year in the Bernabeu was pretty incredible. The year before, obviously, pretty incredible for reasons that City fans will not want to dwell on. But it felt like, as well, I have to sort of mention Bayern Arsenal, but, you know, it felt like we've had so many people this year going, oh, the Champions League's not as good as it used to be, oh, it's boring, oh, it's rubbish, oh, it's not quite as good. Like, that night felt like as good a football night as you can have, basically. Mm-hmm. It was, the City-Real Madrid game was incredible, such good goals, and just an incredible contest between, you know, two European heavyweights. And then, you know, you had Bayern Arsenal alongside that for whoever was able to kind of second stream it or anything like that. But yeah, City and Madrid were just incredible football, incredible spectacle, like one of the best stadiums in certainly Europe. You know, felt up there with Tottenham's for how modern it is. And yeah, the noise was big, and yeah, the night ended with City fans serenading their team off. So another very good night for City.
Before we get onto the game then, what is the new stadium like? Because it's the same old stadium, but they've got the new roof. We heard about the roof a lot in the build-up. It looks a lot different from the outside. Having been there last year and this year, was there a noted difference?
There was a noted difference to the outside, because, I mean, last year it was kind of full of, it was in the middle of being worked on, whereas this year it's all being taken away and it kind of looks like the world's biggest cruise ship. it's properly massive. There's a bit of sort of similarity with, I think, one of the stadiums in Qatar. Was it the Sail one? Right. And then inside, yeah, like the roof is really, It's both really good, but also, like, when nobody's in it, it kind of feels a bit like a soccer dome. Like, right, you're just kind of playing on, yeah, I don't know. But, you know, it just the fact that they're able to do that kind of changes the atmosphere and, you know, adds to the occasion and kept the noise in. There's kind of a very thin, the press box is right at the top of the stadium. So you can see like a very thin layer where you can see outside. But for the players down below, they won't be able to see that, and sort of huge screens all around. And yeah, I mean, it's a class act. And you know, the sort of royal blue seating and the like Real Madrid sign, in the lettering on the bottom tier looks class and kind of, yeah, just similar vibes to Spurs, really. And when you compare it to, say, like the other big stadium in Spain at the Nou Camp that was kind of crumbling a bit, and that's why that's being redeveloped. Like the Bernabeu is kind of exactly the type of thing that City will want with their stadium expansion as a whole, you know, because they're not going to be able to sort of completely redo the stadium, but they will want that. They will want to be similarly attractive because, yeah, you couldn't fail but kind of be impressed by Real. And then, you know, obviously all their the tifos that they did before the kickoff, it was just like, yes, this is one of the biggest clubs in the world, showing and flexing that they are one of the biggest clubs in the world.
Because I've been to the Bernabeu, but before it was redone, and even then it was like, okay, this is a good stadium. You can see where it's been built as they've got more successful, but it feels like, yeah, this redevelopment is sort of a culmination of all that, and they've gone all out, and no one's had a bad word to say about it. Like, you get some redevelopments and they're like, oh, well, where's the money gone? You can see where, yeah, the money's gone, and it has improved one of the best, yeah, stadiums in the, yeah, world.
Yeah, all I can say is it feels like Tottenham, and it makes every other stadium in England feel old, including the Etihad.
Well, there we go. I do want to pull up Pep on something he did say before the game. They've never played in a stadium with the roof on. They did in Houston 2 years ago, because I remember being on that pitch before the game and thinking, I'm so glad that roof is closed and there's air conditioning. So
we know what Pep thinks about friendlies, though.
This is true. He's do not say that F word to Pep. Bit of a unconventional build-up as well. There was a few threats before the game. Was there a sort of different mood in Madrid before the game? It was a bit of a not awkward match day, but not one you will have been expecting.
Yeah, I have to thank my mum, who, when I told her the next day about the threat from Islamic State, she responded with, was it everyone they were targeting or just the journalists? So clearly my mum thinks the standard of match reporting isn't quite up to scratch. It was strange. I wouldn't say it kind of stopped the celebrations from fans from being there in the day. You know, they still enjoyed themselves and had a nice time. Even round the stadium, there was lots of normality, but there was also just humongous police presence around the perimeter of the stadium and like waiting and sort of, you know, the press entrance where we were going in, there were about 20 kind of heavy unit police vans sort of prepared. And there were kind of obviously checks going on all around the stadium. So checks for us to get in were probably more stringent than they usually are. It still felt normal, but there was just kind of a note of caution in the background about it all.
Well, thankfully, we got to see a fantastic game. When the team was announced, I messaged you and was like, are you sure you've got that right? Because there's no Kevin De Bruyne in there. Turns out he's rocked up to the Bernabeu and started vomiting and had to be left out. That would have threatened to sort of derail City, but if anything, it sort of made them a little bit more balanced. Foden was in the middle. Bernardo had a bit more chance to influence the game, and they got off to literally a perfect start with a second-minute goal.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know how they'd have played with De Bruyne, and, you know, they certainly would have rather played with De Bruyne, and it can't have been good getting to the stadium 2 hours before the game or less than that, and De Bruyne just starts throwing up everywhere. Not least because, you know, if you're City, you're then thinking, it'd be a surprise if he was the only one affected by this. And Kovacic is not, you know, City don't have a player like De Bruyne. Foden's probably the closest, but he's not identical. Kovacic's certainly not close to De Bruyne's profile. So you've planned all this, you've planned this game plan, and then you've got to switch it up. And, you know, it happens, and it's happened to City, it's happened to other teams, and you have to adapt with what you have, but it's still not what you want when you're an hour away from the biggest game of your season. So it was tricky, but the start could not have been better, sort of, as we were still kind of reeling from the De Bruyne news. Like, before you know it, Grealish draws a foul, Tchouameni gets a yellow card for a mad tackle in the first minute that rules him out with the second leg. And then Bernardo Silva just kind of pops the ball into the back of the net before kind of Lunin can set himself. And it's no one could quite believe it. And, you know, you've just got Silva kind of running over to the Madrid fans being like, yeah, it's me here again to do what I do.
Remember me.
Yeah, it was really something.
It felt as sort of emphatic as Gundogan's goal in the cup final, in terms of, it wasn't 12 seconds, but it was, nobody expected such a good start, and it felt like it sort of shell-shocked Madrid. But then 15 minutes later, they're ahead and we're setting up for another crazy game between these two sides. And I've blogged quite a few of these City-Madrid games now, and there's never just one goal. It's always two or three goals in a quick succession. And it seems like all tactics go out of the window when they play. Last year's 1-1 draw felt like an anomaly when it was kind of tight and sort of controlled. this felt back to normal of two just brilliant attacks going at each other. And you can have the best defenders in the world, but when you've got the best attackers in the world, they're coming out on top.
Yeah, I think that was it. Last year was a brilliant game at the Bernabeu, but it was two teams kind of sizing each other up, and City kind of squeezing and then Real squeezing. Whereas this time it was more like rugby league. It was like we're going back and forth up your end of the goal and then back. And I think it was the most goals in the there was three goals in the first 14 minutes, which is the most since City v Spurs, which was 2-2 after 11 minutes, which in itself is crazy to think back on. But it felt like, you know, City had really stolen a march by scoring early, and then it felt like they'd not really done anything wrong and they were 2-1 down. And, you know, two deflected goals. I mean, it was just kind of the quality of players. As much as the Real's first two goals were unfortunate, like, it was amazing from Vinicius and Rodrigo for that second goal. And Camavinga was top all night.
Wasn't
it? So, like, you know, as much as he gets the luck with the ball going off Diaz's hip, he was great. And you just kind of have to suck it up and move on. But, you know, I guess City have had quite a few deflected goals against them this season, like two from Arsenal and various others. So they are used to it, but it doesn't make it any easier. And when you've had the joy of going 1-0 up in the second minute to then be 2-1 down after 14 minutes, all these things start building up mentally. And, you know, De Bruyne sat there on the bench not being able to contribute, and you think, we need to stay in this game. And it was a battle in that first half. Real were the better team for pretty much all of the first half, and City had to stay in it.
It felt like City just sort of made the decision, okay, let's go back to what we know. Let's not go for sort of tit-for-tat, ding-dong battle. Let's keep the ball and try and regain a bit of control and composure. And it worked in the first half, and then start the second half thinking, okay, they maybe need to start doing a bit more. And Foden's found in that position where we know he loves to sort of let it out of his feet and have a shot, but he's either closed down or he gives away possession or the shot's not good. And you're thinking, is it going to happen? Have they got any other ideas? Erling Haaland's marked out of the game. And then Foden comes up with one of his best goals of his career. And it feels like we're saying that every other week with Foden, and he's saying it himself. This is one of the best goals of his career, but at the Bernabeu to curl that into the top corner under that pressure. And then we see Guardiola out of nowhere, probably as a result of first touch, but on his right foot, bend that into the far corner. I bet you didn't know what was happening up in that press box.
No, I mean, it was Guardiola's first goal for the club. Has there been a more Guardiola goal than an errant first touch requiring an absolute worldie of a second touch to stick it past the keeper? It was amazing. I mean, yeah, City they still wobbled a bit at the start of the second half, and Vinicius, I think, had a very good chance to make it 3-1, but he hit it over. But City just started being a bit more composed. It was funny because Foden had started in the middle with Bernardo wide, but then that sort of switch in the second half with Bernardo moving inside almost allowed Foden to get more space in the middle, sort of moving in from the right, and, you know, also John Stones being up there on the edge of the box to lay it off the Foden. Stone, that role from Stones is just extraordinary. And yeah, it was a big moment. It was another moment where Foden has taken responsibility, which he's done time and time again this season. And, you know, Tony Rudiger was sort of asked about City's threats before the game, and the first name out of his mouth for players they had to stop was Phil Foden. So that kind of tells you about what an impact he's had this season. And him smacking the ball into the top corner also tells you what an impact he's had. So it was huge. And as Pep said afterwards, City would have lost this game 4-5-1 a few years ago. But they got the goals because they'd hung on in there and stayed stable enough and played their football. And that is exactly what the manager wanted. And it's what they were able to deliver. And, you know, the fans in the top corner of the stadium just could not believe it at 3-2. They were deliriously happy.
They weren't very City goals either, were they? They were, Bernardo's was brilliantly inventive and opportunistic. And then Foden has scored a good few goals like that. But you expect City to score the cutbacks and the sort of the through balls into the box when it's really tight. You don't expect your left back to wallop one in with his right foot and a 40-yard free kick. It felt, for those fans, they're brilliant goals to celebrate, especially at the Bernabeu. But
yeah,
it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was a typical City performance, I thought, but not with typical City goals.
Yeah. I think it's 13 years since they scored three from outside the box in the same game. But that will become more common with Foden because Foden's so good at finishing. And I think he's got six this season from outside the box. So, you know, that will improve as Foden becomes more central. But it is what you need on nights like this. You need the individual talent to stand out. It was just brilliant kind of opportunism and instincts and decision making from City in those tight areas. I know we're going to talk about Haaland in a bit, so I won't mention too much, but sort of, you know, Haaland did not have much of an impact on the game, but the players behind him did and were able to find the space to shoot from distance. And, you know, as much as City were hampered by injuries, you wonder if City would have scored everything they scored if Real had Courtois in goal, because it was definitely kind of a step down from Real with Courtois being injured to have Lunin in net.
A word for Valverde's very, very good equaliser. It felt fair, didn't it? Like, yes, we've talked up City's performance, but I think Real would have been really disappointed not to have at least taken a draw from that first leg.
It might smash and grab maybe a bit too far if they'd won it, but it was certainly Real had enough of the game to feel like a draw was fair. And another just sensational goal. You know, in the press box, there was kind of one giant TV screen that was sort of directly above our line of sight. So you sort of just had to like peer up vertically to try and see what had happened, because like it was difficult to believe watching it on the pitch with your own eyes, like just how good the goal was. It was just an unbelievable technique to level that. So it was kind of it was a decent cross, but it wasn't very much. But just the finish just transformed it, and suddenly the Bernabeu, which had been sort of silenced, was right back at it. And it just felt like, you know, two champion boxers going at each other, and you know, the very best of club football. It was an amazing game.
I think the players and the managers after the game, they were sort of, no one was unhappy after that. I think they're the games that you do want to play in, aren't they? And
and
although you said it feels like a defeat, but they'll remember that game more than many others in the career, because it was just such a high quality.
Yeah, and you know, Valverde says that because they know how good City are and they know how difficult it is to play this City team. And you know, Guardiola was kind of pressed after the game, people trying to say, you know, was it a bad result? You were ahead twice. Is that, you know, disappointing? And he was like, you don't know how difficult it is to score three goals at the Bernabeu. Like, it is really, really hard. And I think I've seen a stat saying he's not won in his last three games there. And it's like, well, yeah, but the 1-1 last year set City up to win the tie, and the 3-3 this year has set City up to win the tie. So, you know, two very, very good results. And and also means City have kept up this stupid record of scoring three goals in every Champions League game this season, which is just defies belief. But boring City.
Some of the performances in the group stage when you're sort of dwindling down, and yeah, it was another three goals in the second leg would go down quite well. We'll be back after a short break, and we'll talk about a couple of individual performances. Haaland, as we mentioned, Foden and Kvaradzic. Hello, welcome back to the Talking City podcast. Si, you touched on it before, all of these great performances, but we didn't see a lot from Erling Haaland. What we did see a lot of was Tchouameni and Antonio Rudiger. Not just man-marking him, but just on him, literally following him on his toes, not letting him move anywhere. Yes, he didn't get involved, but you see those videos and you see the highlights of those two, and Haaland and Rudiger are having a joke about it afterwards.
Yeah.
The way I see that is he's taken two defenders to completely mark him out of the game, and then you can see how Foden and Bernardo and Grealish have utilised that space, but it's not going to stop the critics saying another big game. He's not scored. He's not had an influence.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was on an aisle seat flying home, and Tchouameni and Rudiger were either side, just making sure that he couldn't get out. It was quite something. I sort of fall between the two camps on this one. I was surprised at how happy Real were to leave Rudiger as the only player back for sort of Ortega's long kicks forward to Haaland. And it felt like Haaland kept misjudging the flight of the ball. He just, like, every time the ball came up to him, he never seemed to be able to win it and bring it down properly. And, you know, that felt disappointing. It felt like, you know, an opportunity missed, and like Haaland hadn't played particularly well. At the same time, yeah, he has taken up space with defenders, and by being so high, he's pushed Real back and allowed those players to come forward. Again, I just kind of feel a bit, because like Jamie Carragher's written today saying he's a world-class finisher but not a world-class player. You're like, well, he just is a world-class player. There's no getting around it. If he's that good at finishing, he's a world-class player.
I think that's an easy line that they're trotting out, and Roy Keane.
Yeah,
it's a way to justify that League Two idea.
Yeah, but I don't really know what you gain from it, and I don't really, like, you know, if Haaland scores three goals in the final and wins the treble for City again, are you going to be sat there saying, "Well, I told you he was a League Two player on the build-up"? Like, it's just a bit. It is just nonsense. And I didn't think Haaland played well, but I didn't think that was one of the biggest stories from the evening. You know, it feels like a story because it's Haaland, and everyone wants to comment on Haaland because he's a world-class player and, you know, one of the biggest names and brands in the game. You know, I thought if you're looking at it from a football perspective, you're more interested in kind of City and Real's different approaches. Rodri having a poor game, and Rodri and tiredness and what goes on with that. And then also kind of Foden and, you know, City's defence as well. You know, I spoke to a reporter at half-time, and we were saying, right, well, you know, all City need to do to turn this round is for Rodri, Kovacic, Bernardo, Foden and Haaland to play better. So it wasn't top coaching there, by the way, but it wasn't like every City player played well and Haaland had a stinker. It was, you know, City found success in some parts of the game and not in others. And yeah, maybe Haaland contributed by taking up the defenders. He definitely kind of could have done better with his individual duels, but it wasn't like a major talking point in the game. So his performance didn't kind of merit the amount of analysis and coverage his performance has had, I would say.
I did hear that was Pep Guardiola's halftime team talk, by the way. Just play better. Just do it. Although, having seen the documentary, sometimes it is as simple as that, isn't it? It's not the sort of in-depth analysis you do expect. Yeah, I think Real Madrid wouldn't have put two men on him if they didn't think he was a world-class player and didn't know his threats. So it's the same thing we've been talking about for 2 years now, that if if you mark Haaland out of the game, you've also got to stop the rest of the players. And yeah, they did a good job of marking Haaland out, but they didn't stop the rest, and they conceded three goals. And you would have to say City are favourites going into the second leg. And I don't think that performance is going to stop Real being interested in Haaland for the rest of his career.
No, and also, as kind of mentioned around the Keane coverage, like, finisher is such a reductive term. Like, if Haaland scores a goal, it's because he's found space in a world-class way or put himself in a position that only a world-class player would to deliver a world-class finish. It's not just like, oh, well, he's absolutely useless on a football field, but he can sort of smack it in from anywhere. It's you don't really see that from Haaland. It's not like he scored that many goals from outside the box. They tend to come from inside the box, which would demonstrate that there is a lot to his play that is significantly better than a lot of world-class defenders can cope with.
I think he went a run of about 50, 60 goals without scoring from outside the box, and the ones that did were sort of a one-on-one situation. And yeah, it's there was a point just before Foden's goal where Foden had tried to do that shot. He'd done a couple of efforts that he hadn't fully got hold of, and he just lost the ball and Real broke, and the only player running back was Haaland, and he just nicked it off the toe of, I think it was Vinicius, or might have been Rodrigo.
Yeah, it was Vinicius, yeah. He chased back Vinicius, yeah. It's, yeah, and then Real got the throw. Real got the throw, Vinicius started it again, and Haaland tackled him. So it was like, yeah, League Two player right there, tackling one of the best players in the world.
Having watched a lot of League Two football, I would love my strikers to do that.
I'd quite like to see Vinicius in League Two, actually. That would be.
I don't think he'd cut it. The pitches aren't right for him. Phil Foden, we've touched on him. Before the game, you were sort of building up the Bellingham-Foden comparison, and it was definitely Foden's night. And I think there was a report in Sport in Spain saying that there are concerns over, has Bellingham been overused? Is he struggling with fitness? Has he sort of burnt out already this season? And he just looked a bit tired. He didn't have the best game. And when we're thinking who's going to start at number 10 for England, it feels like it's Bellingham's position, but Foden looked the more competent and quality number 10 at the Bernabeu, didn't he? It feels like it supported your pre-match view that Foden's a better fit for that number 10.
I think there was a bit of surprise at how Ancelotti kind of used Rodrigo, Vinicius and Bellingham. But it clearly worked to enable Rodrigo to score and Vinicius to, cause City a lot of problems. Bellingham just didn't cause City any problems. There was that absolutely meaty tackle from Diaz that sent him flying, but fairly. Bellingham spent most of the game complaining to the referee. He's obviously a hugely talented player, and has done it against City and many other teams on many stages, but this really wasn't his night. He was kind of peripheral to the overall game, and it kind of, he did really well late on, I think when it was 3-3 in the last minutes, to kind of get into the box and bring a ball down, and then couldn't do anything with it. And that kind of summed up his night, a player that has kind of done so well this season at kind of scoring important goals and being there exactly where you need him to be, just kind of wasn't at it. And at the other end, you had Foden grabbing the game by the scruff of its neck and saying, I am going to be one of the major players in this contest and do this for my team. So, if you're looking at it as kind of Foden versus Bellingham on the night, there was one clear winner.
I think it's, with the England debate, it's similar to the City and De Bruyne debate, in that De Bruyne is better and can only really play at number 10 for City, and similar for Bellingham. But you've got Foden, who looks very, very good in the centre, but also, like you mentioned, he probably played better at Real Madrid when he was out on the wing and coming inside next to Bernardo at number 10. So I know everybody wants to see Foden as the number 10. But I feel like he's versatile enough and clever enough now in that position where you can come inside for club and country and still be just as effective, but that way you're also getting the most of your number 10 at the same time.
Yeah, and, you know, Thierry Henry, who just seems to get better and better as a pundit, particularly with Pep City, was kind of asked about it after the game on CBS, and he was just like, you can't compare, really. Like, you know, how do England play? Do they play like City? Do they play with one holding midfielder, or do they need two with a 10? Like, how does their attack shape up to City's? How does everything else match up to City's? And, you know, it's not like which one is better, but clear, like, stylistic differences. And Southgate has kind of never shown that Foden will be or has been central to his plans and how he wants to set the team up. So it would kind of be a surprise if he went like that for the Euros, because, like, you've spent 2 years building up in a different way. I know kind of Bellingham's emerged over the last year or so, but, like, it's still been a year. So I would kind of be surprised if Southgate went, you know what, I'm going to make Foden central to everything and build everything around him now. But Foden is playing so well at City that his kind of struggle to make an impact with the national team would seem to reflect more badly on England than it does Foden.
I think as well, we're judging Bellingham off one bad performance, or not even a bad performance, just one where he's not been as good as other players on the pitch.
Yeah, exactly. I think the only thing is with Bellingham is that he has been, you know, hyped up to, like, beyond anything we've seen before, as, like, the next generational talent. And I think he's still very young, and England actually have a lot of players who could fit into that bracket. You know, it's a hell of a generation coming through. So, you know, as good as Bellingham is and could be, there are plenty of others that can make an impact, and Foden certainly made more impact than him on Tuesday night.
A quick word on Josko Gvardiol, who was a major doubt going into the game after limping off or being substituted against Crystal Palace. He didn't train on Monday. Then he was named in the travelling squad. When Guardiola spoke to you guys on Monday evening, he didn't seem too confident. And then suddenly he's in at left back, which just gave the back four so much more balance than had he not been there. And then he puts in a very good performance and scores a good goal. It seems like it's clicking for him now at City.
Yeah, it felt like, I mean, he was probably helped by the fact that Vinicius and Rodrigo both kind of went down the left.
Yeah.
So he didn't have to deal with that particularly. But yeah, like you say, it was just a big boost to have him in the team. And it felt like City were more kind of secure, as much as Rico Lewis would have done a very good job, but he just would have changed things that sort of would have made things maybe more difficult for the team, and would have had a hell of a job up against Real's two wingers. So yeah, he's done very well. And then, like, Stones as well, playing through a bit of pain and playing really, really well in that more advanced role in the second half to get an assist. I don't know if he's got any Champions League assists before this week. He certainly had that goal that he scored against Dortmund last year that was pretty special. So he continues to show why sort of keeping him fit will be so key.
Yeah, after all the talk of what could the defence look like, it actually held relatively firm, even though conceded three. It just looked a bit more balanced. I think Akanji is quietly very good at these big games, and maybe could have done better for the sort of Rodrigo goal. But all in all, to play against those two sides, like you say, on that right side, did all right.
Yeah, he could have done, but he's unfortunate because he actually gets back and recovers, and then it's the deflection that sees it into the net. So,
and you probably wouldn't tell him to do anything differently.
No, exactly. So he did very well over two legs last year against Real at left back, and he was pretty good again last night.
I think he's done an interview saying he just doesn't have a position anymore. His position is defender and will fill in wherever he's needed, and he's getting increasingly
and he's been
reliable.
Very good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
we'll park Real Madrid for now, but as we know, the second leg is coming up, and next week we've got four podcasts, I believe. We'll be there on Monday to talk about Luton. On Tuesday, we'll be at the open training session and press conference, where we'll hear from Pep, hear from a player, and see who's training. There'll surely be some injury or fitness updates, given how many doubts there are in the squad and have been popping up. On Wednesday, we'll give you a little bit of reaction from the game. There's three of us going to the Etihad to see if City can book a semi-final place. So you'll hear from us after the whistle at the Etihad. And then Friday, we'll be looking forward to the small matter of the FA Cup semi-final against Chelsea. So on your podcast platforms and on YouTube, you will find us there ahead of Real Madrid, after Real Madrid and ahead of Chelsea. And after this break, we'll come back and talk about Luton and what to do with Rodri. Welcome back to part three of the Talking City podcast. Now, if you could cherry pick a fixture in between two games against Real Madrid, losing at home is probably one of the main contenders that you would pick at the start of the season. But it feels like City might have United to do at it. Home. No comment. To be fair, we've seen Luton twice against City, and yes, City have scored eight goals, but Luton have caused them problems and look quite good. That's why I'm not saying it's the one you pick, because I think there are others, but I don't think any side has conceded more on the travels this season than Luton, and however good they were in the Cup, City still scored six, so you would expect City to win and keep up the pressure. But we heard from Rodri and he said he needs a rest. You've got De Bruyne, who may or may not be recovered. Foden picked up a dead leg. You've got Kyle Walker and Nathan Ake, who, even if they're back, we don't know if they will be. We're going to the press conference later. Do you play them? Do you risk them? Stones, as you say, playing through injury. It feels like a game to make a lot of changes, and especially with Rodri begging for a rest. Surely you don't start Rodri, do you?
No, surely not. I mean, Rodri was bad on Tuesday night, and I know it's sort of bad by his standards, and his standards are higher than most people's. But because he barely kind of misplaces a pass, it's very strange when he does sort of misplace several passes in his own half. And yeah, he played like a guy whose feet weren't completely connected to his brain, and came out afterwards and said, "I'm tired and rest." So, you know, I don't think he asked for more rest in summer, and he's not really got it because he's so difficult to replace, and sort of none of their decisions in the summer transfer window enabled them to find someone who can step in for him properly. I think they're in a position where they've got Lewis and Kovacic, who can play that role against Luton, but wouldn't start against Real Madrid. So it makes sense to sort of rest him. But the rest of the team is more difficult because, like you say, there are so many kind of things that might be all right, but might be issues. And you've also got a Premier League title race where there's still kind of still all to play for, and once again for the second weekend City play first, and they have the opportunity to go 2 points clear at the top of the league and ask an Arsenal team who struggled against Bayern and sort of aren't used to the physical and mental demands of Champions League knockout football, and a Liverpool team who absolutely tanks against United and Atalanta, to catch them up. So, you know, again, if City don't win on Saturday, then they're third with the top two having a game in hand on them. Whereas if they win, they can put that pressure on. So they can't afford the Real Madrid game, as much as they will need to kind of make changes with that in mind. They can't afford to get too distracted.
Yeah, it is a tricky one because Guardiola will never look ahead. And I think Foden and Guardiola, when they did their interviews, said, yeah, we can think about the second leg, but we've got to beat Luton first, and that's the priority. At the same time, when you've got players telling they need a rest, this is kind of the one that you do it. And I'm thinking back to the cup game. Rodri didn't start, and it was Kovacic and Nunes instead. And yes, you had De Bruyne and Haaland and Bernardo and Grealish. That helps you score 6 goals. But I think it is a game where you can definitely rest Rodri. I think Stones can be rested, and Lewis can come in, and you can rotate the defence with your substitutions, even if you're not doing it with your starting 11. And I think I wrote that maybe it's one that Sergio Gomez starts. I'm not sure. I've been slept on that. I still agree, but...
No.
Is there any game that Sergio Gomez starts in that case?
The league games after City have already wrapped up the title.
Oh, the Calvin Phillips threshold.
Yes. Yeah.
But we played Oscar Bob at Crystal Palace and did well, and I'm thinking, could he come in? And Alvarez is ready to come in. Does De Bruyne, if he's fit, if he's ready? There are changes he can make, and I think he will do as many as possible.
Yeah, I think so. A Kovacic, Nunes, De Bruyne in midfield sounds pretty good. Haaland, Doku. Yeah, maybe Bob. And then Lewis. I think you're probably going to go Lewis, Diaz, Akanji, Guardiola. They say make some changes during the game. I'd see no reason why Sergio Gomez can't get like half an hour or 40 minutes or something like that. I just don't think they would want him to start necessarily.
I did feel sorry for him at Crystal Palace. He's ready to come on. He was stripped and ready, and then Palace scored their second, and it was 4-2, and Bernardo comes on instead, and he looked a little bit heartbroken. He was like, I'm finally on the pitch.
Yeah. But, they will have that. I think Leicester at home was before a FA Cup semi or FA Cup quarter last year, and, City went 3-0 up, and then Pep made a host of changes, including Calvin Phillips on, and they were dreadful and very nearly drew the game. Maybe 3-1, so not very nearly, but they certainly, Leicester had the chances to draw. So that will be in Guardiola's mind. So he'll want to play a strong team because he values the league so highly. But I think if they can rest Rodri, Foden, Stones, Bernardo, that will be enough.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be one of them. If City do 3-0 up, or maybe even 2 goals, he'll start using his substitutes to really show who he wants to play against Real Madrid as well. And as much as we've been talking about goal difference, it's probably one way you just manage the game in the second half if you can, rather than exert any energy you don't need to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like Liverpool's result kind of takes goal difference out the window.
I suppose, yeah.
Arsenal and Liverpool are a point ahead of them. So if City win one more game than Arsenal or Liverpool do over the stretch, then goal difference doesn't come into it. If City drop points, then it does again. But, I think the way City have got to be looking at it, which is we need to keep winning, it's goal difference has kind of become less relevant.
Yeah, and Liverpool have just fallen off a bit, haven't they? They're too bad against United. They were not great against, was it Brentford? Or Sheffield United it was, sorry. And obviously that Atalanta result felt like it came out of nowhere, but could be quite damaging, but also could give them a few more days to prepare some late games if they are knocked out. So I don't know. It's probably not a great time for them to be hitting a sticky patch of form.
No, I mean, I think the thing is, they're still both ahead of City. Liverpool and Arsenal need to do worse in their remaining games than City do for City to win the league. So it is still City are third at the minute, but it does feel like they have momentum and it feels like the other competitions are helping. If Liverpool lose to Atalanta, it'll be like, oh, right, well, they only have the league now. So maybe it will help them, but can't have felt great to lose 3-0 at home to Atalanta, whereas drawing 3-0 at Real Madrid felt great for City and added to the idea that they're a brilliant football team that can win trophies. With Liverpool, they've gone from this team where Alexander Arnold saying 2 months ago he wants the quad, and you're now thinking, is the Carabao Cup all Jurgen Klopp's going to be left with in his final season? So I think the sort of mental aspect of that and psychological aspect all does come into play at this stage of the season. And if City can keep going in all competitions, and, you know, they play Real on Wednesday, Arsenal go to the Allianz on Wednesday, needing to win against Bayern. So again, you can spin it whichever way you want, but I kind of feel like, as much as City's busy schedule may catch up with them, they kind of gain momentum in the Premier League from what they do in other competitions.
Yeah, we've learned the last few fixtures now, and there's a Saturday 12:30 and at Fulham, a trip 3 days later to Tottenham in the final week, and depending on the Champions League fixtures, it could be a Wednesday, Saturday, Tuesday run in the sort of three of the last four games. And every time you look at it, there's a different permutation, and Liverpool's possible exit from the Europa League adds another dimension. And Guardiola's never going to be happy with the schedule, is he? But at least City kind of know what they're going to do now, apart from those Brighton and Forest games, which might change.
Yeah, and as bad as the fixtures are, they are ticking down. And, you know, it should be said, it's an incredible achievement that it's the 12th of April and City are in with a really good chance of winning the treble in consecutive years. Like, it is astonishing. And there aren't really that many games left. You know, is it 8 in the league and then possibly 4 in the Champions League and 2 in the FA Cup? Like, they're coming down. We'll be in single figures before you know it. And if City is still in reach of what they want with single figure games, then as tired as they may be, they will be kind of that bit more determined to put in and get the results they need.
Can I get a prediction against Luton, please?
3-1, I think.
Haaland, yeah, I think Luton have a shout of a goal. I don't know. I'm going to say 3-0, but maybe not a thrilling one, because I think it'll be an early one. We've got a 6-1 shout from our producer in the chat here, so we'll see what happens against Luton. As ever, we'll be there. We'll be at Pep's press conference shortly on Friday, so by the time you listen to this, we'll know a bit more on De Bruyne, Foden, Walker, Ake, those sort of names. And you can find all that on the Manchester Evening News, all the latest as it happens at the Etihad on Saturday. And as we mentioned, 4 podcasts or videos next week around the Real Madrid and Chelsea games. So we will see you then. And we will see if City can keep their treble hopes alive next week. But before that, they've got to beat Luton in the Premier League. Thanks for joining us.